professor at Texas A&M. Her name was Virginia Owens. She assigned the Sermon on the Mount to her freshman English class. She asked them to read it and just give an honest assessment of what they felt about this as just a piece of literature. One student said this, "The things asked in this sermon are absurd. To look at a woman is adultery? That is the most extreme, stupid, unhuman statement that I have ever heard." Friends, that was 30 years ago that student wrote that. Well, I imagine that there might be some here this morning who completely agree with that sentiment. I also imagine that it's probably somewhat more likely that there are more of us who would never actually say anything quite like that, and yet still, there's some part of us that kind of resonates with that. Like, you almost feel like you kind of want to apologize for the extremeness of Jesus' words. And quite honestly, this is where a lot of people just have hang-ups with Christianity. I mean, people ask questions, why does God care so much about what we do with our bodies and who we do it with? Why does it seem like Christianity has such a negative view of sexuality and humanity? Listen, I can understand how it might seem like that. I honestly can. But this morning, I want all of us to just take a closer look. I want to invite all of us to take a closer look this morning because, in fact, I think when we really listen closely to what Jesus is saying, when we really listen closely, when we really understand exactly what it is that Jesus is really saying here, I think that we actually find the opposite is the case. I think what we actually find is that Jesus' teaching here, his teaching on adultery and lust, actually gives us a much, much higher view of sexuality and humanity, not a lower one. I think when we actually see what Jesus says, we understand that he's giving us a more reasonable view that treats the power of sex and attraction with the respect that it deserves, and one that more reasonably upholds the dignity of who we are as human beings. My hope is that we all might come to see the goodness of all that Jesus teaches here, and not that we would even feel a sense of apologizing for it, but that we might even feel all the more drawn to him and to the goodness of his vision for our lives. So how are we going to do that this morning? Well, I want to try at least. I'm going to do my best to do that in just three moves. I want to begin where Jesus does with these well-known words. Well-known words. Those are the words that Jesus says in verse 27, he says, "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery." All Jesus is doing here is quoting. It's an exact, direct quote from the Old Testament, from one of the Ten Commandments. This one specifically, the seventh commandment, "You shall not commit adultery." Now, in a most basic kind of technical sense, the most simple, basic kind of limited definition of what adultery is simply having a sexual relationship with somebody else's spouse. Listen, the fact that Jesus is actually affirming this Old Testament prohibition against doing that is not controversial at all. Like I said, these are well-known words. All of his listeners would have known this. He even says, "You've heard that it was said." He's banking on them knowing this, not just knowing this, but agreeing with this. And here's the thing. These well-known words are actually well-known to us today as well. Like, this point, at least, is not controversial. A handful of years ago, there was a survey across 70 countries across the globe. 70 countries across our entire globe, and of all the respondents in all those 70 countries, greater than 75% agreed that adultery is morally wrong. Every single country was over 50%, except France. I don't know what that means. And I don't know why I said it other than to get you to chuckle, because I knew that it would, even though I don't know why. Look, to say you shall not commit adultery is not even controversial, even today. But what is controversial is the reason why everyone listening to Jesus' words back then would have agreed with these well-known words. You see, even then, even back then, even in this very brief command, you shall not commit adultery, that's already reflective of a larger view of marriage and sex that's taught all throughout the Old Testament. Friends, the clear and consistent teaching of the same scriptures that Jesus affirms and upholds right here in the Sermon on the Mount is that sex is only ever meant to be safely enjoyed within a lifelong covenant marriage between one man and one woman. In fact, that was so assumed that to most of these listeners, probably to every single one of these listeners, by the time they heard Jesus' words, they wouldn't have thought adultery is anyone who has a sexual relationship with someone else's spouse. They would have understood that any sexual relationship outside of marriage is in the large, broad category even of adultery. And friends, the reason why Jesus is beginning with saying adultery is wrong is because it violates, it goes against the goodness of the boundaries of this covenant relationship that God designed sex to be enjoyed within. And not only does it go outside those boundaries, but the act itself actually destroys and breaks down those very boundaries themselves. And this is where people will often object. They'll say, well, why does Jesus even need to address issues of sex and marriage at all? And why do they need to be restrictive? The question I want to ask is, why wouldn't he address them? I think sometimes there is this assumption that any kind of restriction in the area of sex is unnecessarily trying to stigmatize human sexuality and make it more of a big deal than it needs to be. But look, I don't think that's a fair critique. And I say that because it's typically, if not always, the same voices that say, look, sex is not that big a deal, and all of you kind of religious and conservative types, you make it out to be such a big deal, it's not that big a deal. The same voices also say, the only way I can ever truly be myself is if nobody else ever pushes any kind of restrictions on me when it comes to sex, because I am only free. I am only truly free to express myself and to realize the totality of my identity when I can live in the absolute total absence of any sexual restrictions at all. I want to say, who's the one making it into a bigger deal than it really is? Listen, we know it's a big deal. We know it's a big deal. It is one of the most powerful aspects of human relationships, which is why Jesus wants to talk about it. In fact, it's precisely because we know that it's a big deal. We should expect Jesus, who's coming to us with a vision for all of human life, we should expect him to have something to say about this, one of the most significant aspects of human life. But even more than that, just because of what Jesus affirms here, just because what he affirms is restrictive doesn't mean it's devaluing. In other words, just because he affirms this basic command that restricts sexual activity to a covenant relationship doesn't mean that he thinks human sexuality is bad. In fact, quite the contrary. And in fact, I think you'll be glad that I decided against this. But the Bible celebrates human sexuality. And there are some passages in the Bible that celebrate it in such a way that if I were to read them out loud to you right now, you would blush. I consider doing that. Take a peek at the Song of Songs a little bit later today. See if you can figure out what all that figurative language is actually getting at. Listen, friends, Jesus is not saying that human sexuality is bad. By saying it needs to be safely confined, he's not saying it's bad. Any more than if you were to come over to my house and see my fireplace and think, oh man, this guy must think fires are terrible. Like, that is absolutely absurd. In fact, if you were to go over someone's house and find that they had a fireplace in every single room, what would you conclude? You would conclude that they really like fire. But in every instance, they understand that it's dangerous and that it is meant to be enjoyed. It's not meant to just kind of break out freely in absence of any restriction, and the enjoyment of it in a safe, restricted area is not a devaluing of it at all. In fact, it is only that that helps us to actually enjoy it. Look, I say all that just as the starting point here. Jesus is just kind of saying, like, he's just beginning with getting on the same page as his listeners. And the reality is that he was on the same page as his listeners about all of this, even though we may stand pretty far away from where his listeners did in terms of our kind of sexual ethic. But make no mistake, Jesus was not there simply to affirm some kind of traditional conservative family values. He wasn't just there to speak well-known words they already knew. Because what he says next would have shocked all of them. So we move from well-known words to words never heard before. In verse 28, he says, but I say to you, yeah, like you understand, we all agree, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Friends, these words are absolutely radical. And they are radically good. But the only reason the only way we'll be able to see that is if we first kind of just tease out what he's not saying. Okay, what Jesus is not saying, he's not talking about just simply noticing someone who's attractive. He's not saying that any kind of physical attraction is bad or evil. What Jesus is talking about is when attraction goes from noticing to looking with lustful intent. It's the lingering look. It's the second glance. It's the look that begins to take mental snapshots. It's looking while allowing the imagination to begin to entertain what an actual physical interaction might be like. That's what Jesus is actually talking about. That's what he's actually prohibiting. And listen, he's also not saying that it's the exact same thing as adultery. Don't make that mistake. Jesus, in fact, nowhere does the Bible say that all sins are exactly the same. He's not saying that. Don't make that mistake. What he is saying, though, is that when it comes to righteousness, and when it comes to righteousness in this particular area of life, do not think that you can just simply not commit adultery and consider yourself righteous. Remember, righteousness is the chief thing that Jesus is chiefly concerned about right here in this section of the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5. He's not talking about how one becomes righteous, so don't make that mistake either. He's not saying that you can somehow earn a particular kind of righteousness by your sexual purity. He's not talking about becoming righteous, but he is talking about redefining the righteousness that the Pharisees had, which was an external-only kind of righteousness. He's giving us a kingdom righteousness. He's giving us a kind of life that's lived under the rule and reign of God, that seeks, that desires to live out the will of God in every single aspect of life in a way that the internal person, what goes on in the internal person, matches what goes on in the external person. He's also not saying, you know, that old commandment about adultery, that just was not strict enough, so now I'm going to change it. No, what he's saying is that real righteousness, real kingdom righteousness, the heart and the life and the thoughts and the actions and the words and the deeds of a follower of Christ in his kingdom, they take that old commandment about adultery and they apply it as deeply as they possibly can at the deepest heart level so that you don't even look at another person with lustful intent. Friends, what Jesus is doing, he's not just simply affirming these kind of traditional kind of conservative sex ethics. He's actually challenging every one of his listeners, probably all of whom would have never technically committed adultery. Adultery was extremely uncommon back then because there were strict, severe consequences. Jesus is speaking to people who would have upheld all the external values. And he's saying, no, listen, real kingdom righteousness is so much more than just that. To put it simply, yes, God cares about what we do with our bodies. Yes, God cares about what we do with one another, and he should. He made us. He designed all this. He knows how it works best. He knows best what is harmful and what is fruitful and good. He knows that we are embodied beings, but he cares more than just about what we do on the outside with our bodies. He cares about the totality of our beings. He cares about our hearts. He cares about what we look at, who we look at, and how we look at them. And I, for one, I'm glad that he does. You should be too. Look, I realize that one way to take this is to say, man, God is just being way too strict. I realize that's one way to take this. But another way to take this, I think the right way to take this, is that God actually loves us. And he knows that we are complex beings who don't just have external lives and external realities. He knows that we are complex human beings that have internal lives and internal realities. I mean, do you really want a God who says, hey, listen, I don't care what you do on the inside at all. I don't care what or who you look at or think about at all. So long as you just kind of follow these basic external rules and just don't do X, Y, Z. A God who doesn't care about what goes on in your heart is not a God who is worthy of our unending devotion and worship. This is good that he cares about this. He cares about this because he cares about us. And if we want to take following Jesus seriously, we've got to care about it too. And listen, friends, the implications of what Jesus is saying here, are incredible. Look, I realize that anybody, any person, any individual, man or woman, can be tempted to look lustfully at another person. Anybody. And so there is a sense in which, generally speaking, this just applies to all of us. And yet at the same time, Jesus words this in such a way that seems to indicate that this is a particular problem for men, looking lustfully at women. And I don't want us to miss that. There is a particular reason why Jesus says it the way that he does. And right there is wherein lies so much of the beauty and the value of what Jesus is saying. You know, back then, so many of the people that would have affirmed the basic prohibition about adultery, the reason why they would have agreed that you shall not commit adultery is because they would have seen their wives as part of their property. And so committing adultery with a man's wife is like taking part of his property. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying, back then, culturally, that's what a lot of people would have assumed is undergirding that basic command. And what Jesus is saying, Jesus' words just, they rip right through that. He's saying it's not about property, it's about dignity. It's about human dignity. It's about who we actually are as human beings, men and women made in the image of God. Friends, listen to this, and men especially, listen to this. God did not simply create women to be the objects of your sexual attention. That is not what women are for. And Jesus, right here, even all the way back then, is laying that down right here. Or as somebody else put it so eloquently this past week, gawking at women is super creepy. Like, it is. But it's not just that it's super creepy. It completely misunderstands what God, or how and why God made us both male and female with equal value, dignity, and worth. In fact, what Jesus is doing here is Jesus is actually creating a context, or he's at least creating the conditions for a context in which men and women can relate to each other without any of this needing to be on the table. There is an essential goodness in that. That also means, if it's true that men need to be reminded that God did not make women simply to be looked at, it's also probably important to remind women that God did not make you simply to be looked at, or to be judged, or to be evaluated, essentially, based on your attractiveness. Which I think is good news. It's good news for those who perhaps see themselves as attractive. That is not a shameful thing to be. It's also good news for those who maybe don't see themselves as attractive, because that has nothing to do with your essential purpose or worth or value or identity. And the possibility and the goodness of all that is implied right here with Jesus' good, restrictive words, because he cares about how we look at each other, and he cares about how you want to be looked at by others. He cares. Do you know what else he cares about? Even when there's nobody else around and nobody else can see you but him, he still cares about what you look at. He cares about what you look at on your computer screen or on your television screen or on a magazine page. He cares about all of it. Friends, make no mistake, just because the images that you look at can't see you looking, it is still every bit a violation of what Jesus is putting forward right here. And it is every bit a participation in the devaluing of the human dignity of whoever it is you're looking at. Look, just in case I'm not being clear enough, I'm talking about pornography, which is an entire industry, a massive industry, an industry that actually dwarfs like Hollywood and basic film industry. It dwarfs it in terms of the amount of money that it makes, all built upon pure exploitation of men and women, but especially women. And looking at that is completely inconsistent with any kind of kingdom righteousness. Looking at that actually makes you complicit in an industry built on the exploitation of others. Listen, here's the thing. When for years and years, the world told us, it's a normal thing, it's a natural thing, you don't need to worry about that, people can embrace that, we shouldn't be engaged in censorship, it's healthy, it's good. But people are beginning to actually sound the alarm. Even people who are not religious people are already beginning to sound the alarm. Friends, the reality is that we are living in a society that has a far more dangerous pandemic than anyone has ever named. This is destroying human relationships. And it's affecting everybody. It's affecting men and women. It's affecting everybody. It's affecting non-Christians and Christians. It's affecting our marriages, and it's affecting our ability to have healthy, normal friendships with members of the opposite sex. It's affecting our work lives. There was a recent study done, it was published in The Atlantic, said that you might imagine, with the cultural value on the absence of any kind of sexual restrictions, you might imagine that young people in today's society are having more sex than ever before. Like, we'd probably imagine that, right? It's not true. Actually, the number of young people who are reporting having sexual relationships, even outside of marriage, it's going down and down and down. And part of the reason is because the number of people getting married is going down. But the other big reason is because of pornography. And especially, it affects everybody, but especially men who are saying, you know what? I don't want to deal with the challenges of an actual relationship. I don't want to deal with the challenges of an actual person. I'll just go ahead and look at this, and that'll be good enough. What kind of effect is that going to have on our society and another generation? But not even just that, like even other non-Christian, like science people, scientists, actually is what you call those, They're even beginning to warn us of the dangers of this. So like my favorite, those of you who know me, you kind of know where I'm going with this. My favorite non-Christian podcast to listen to is Huberman. Huberman Labs, Huberman Podcast. Some of you like are giving me the nod, right? And when I say non-Christian, it's not anti-Christian, it's just not coming from a human perspective. Andrew Huberman is a professor of neurobiology and ophthalmology at Stanford University, but like he's cool. I don't know why you felt the need to say that, but I don't know what picture you had when you heard like professor of like neurobiology. Yeah, like right, like kind of nerdy. Like, but he's like really cool. He's got this great podcast where he talks about science. And one of the things that he talks about, one of the most important things that he says that every one of us needs to avoid is looking at pornography. Because of how it destroys the human brain, how it negatively affects and destroys our social lives, even our work lives. People begin to feel that they can no longer even find motivation to do some of their basic activities at work because they're constantly being stimulated and overstimulated by looking at things on screens that they shouldn't be looking at. Friends, even people who don't believe in Jesus are sounding the alarm on this, and long before we had any kind of science-backed protocols, Jesus is standing here with the solution, with the goodness that he's instructing us of coming into his kingdom and saying, listen, this is not how life should be. He's holding out something so much better. So what do you do? What do you do if this is a particular temptation in your life? Well, the answer is somewhat simple. Not really, but it's somewhat simple. You do whatever it takes. You absolutely do whatever it takes. And here we move from these radically new words. I'm sorry. Yes, radically new words, words never heard before, to words that need to be taken seriously. The words that Jesus speaks in verses 29 and 30 are to be taken very seriously, even though they are not to be taken literally. When Jesus says, if your right eye, or, I pointed to my left, if Jesus says, if your right eye or your right hand causes you to sin, pluck it out or cut it off. He is speaking intentionally, hyperbolically to grab our attention. He's not speaking literally. And I realize that anytime I stand up here and I say that Jesus isn't speaking literally about, or if I'm saying anything in the Bible isn't literal, there are some people who are like, you begin to get like a little bit upset. You kind of like fold your arms and like kind of like squint your eyes, but I'm betting you're folding both of your arms and squinting both of your eyes. Point being is like, you may not like that I'm not saying it's not literal, but I'm guessing you have both your eyes and both your hands. I'm guessing you haven't taken this literally. And so, if that's you, if you want to take this super literally, just in case, we have recently purchased a pneumatic eye plucker. It's called the See No Evil 5000. It's available for usage right there at the bookstall right after the service, and please, one per customer only. You're laughing because that's absurd, and Jesus knows that. He's intentionally saying something that is very extreme to be intentionally provocative, to provoke you to respond in a certain way, to take his words with a certain seriousness. Again, we know that he didn't mean it literally because his followers didn't take it literally, not to mention, if you pluck out your right eye, your left eye can still cause you to sin. If you cut off your right hand, your left hand can still cause you to sin. Jesus knows that. So what is he saying? Look, he's simply saying here is a seemingly drastic measure. In fact, who among us would say that's not a drastic measure? Like ripping out an eye, cutting off a hand, it's a seemingly drastic measure. However, compared to the consequence, it's actually kind of small. Like compared to the consequence of having your whole body come under the judgment of God and thrown into hell, making this one smaller, even though seemingly drastic, sacrifice is actually reasonable compared to the larger thing. Now listen, please don't misunderstand this. Jesus is not simply saying, if you ever commit any sort of lust of the eye or the heart, you are going to hell, that's it, full case, stop, done. He's not saying that at all. What he's simply saying is that if you don't see the loss of one thing, if you don't see the loss of one thing as worth the small sacrifice of losing out of that one thing in order to gain a larger reality, if that doesn't reflect the seriousness with which you understand Jesus' words about the nature of lust and adultery, that means that you don't really have a heart concern for the kind of righteousness that Jesus wants us to have to be in his kingdom. That's what Jesus is saying. But practically speaking, what does that mean for you? That may actually mean that if you are unwilling to take drastic steps to address even the sin of what you look at, then there's a chance that you may not ultimately be concerned. You may not ultimately share Jesus' concern with the kind of kingdom righteousness that he wants you to have as a follower of his. And if you do not have any of the same concern to live out the righteousness that he wants you to have concern for, then it does necessarily beg the question, in what possible sense are you actually following Christ? So no, these aren't literal words, but we are absolutely meant to take them seriously. So friends, take drastic steps. Take drastic steps. Cancel whatever subscriptions you need to cancel. Use whatever internet filters you need to use. Perhaps get off social media if that is an area of temptation for you. I kind of wanted to say get off social media, but I can't really say that. Get off social media if that is a particular area of temptation for you. And you're like, well, wait a minute, that's not the same thing as like pornography and that kind of thing. Okay. Why are you so concerned with your coworker's beach vacation? Just stop. Just stop. Just get off of there. Maybe consider not even having a smartphone. Some of you are like, oh, that's crazy. That's so extreme. Cut out your eye. Cut off your hand. We ought to be willing to take extreme measures because they're actually small in comparison to the larger kingdom righteousness that Jesus wants us to break. But here's the thing. None of those steps will do anything for you apart from the step that you must take. You must come to Jesus with your sin. You must. Do not hear me for a second saying, you better go get this cleaned up in your life, and then when you do, then you can come to Christ. That is completely wrong. That is completely false. In fact, Jesus knows that none of us can address any of this apart from coming to him in the first place. Listen, when you heard me say that Jesus' words aren't literal here about plucking out an eye or cutting off a hand, did you breathe a sigh of relief? Because you shouldn't have. Because what Jesus actually is calling you to do is far more drastic. If you truly come to Christ, if you truly come to him in faith and repentance, if you come to him and believe in him, and these are words that we just kind of chuck out all the time. If you think that means that, well, I just kind of believe that he existed, and if I believe that, then I'm going to be forgiven for whatever I can do, and I can just kind of live however I want, you are completely mistaken. And if you think that when Jesus says that you need to come to him and submit every part of your life to him, if you think that you will not find your life far more altered than the loss of an eye or a hand, you are mistaken. Because Jesus intends to change everything about your life, including your heart. Which is really the problem here. And Jesus doesn't say, go get a new heart and come back and talk to me then. No, coming to Christ is how you get a new heart. And he is the one. Because of what he accomplished for us on the cross, by taking all of our sin, even our sexual sin and our lustful looking and the idolatry and the adultery of our hearts, by taking all of that onto himself on the cross and paying for it with the perfection and the sinlessness of his life, he could wipe the debt clean, but also God raised him from the dead and he ascended into heaven where he sends his spirit, and his spirit rips out our old, dead hearts and gives us new ones. New ones that imperfectly, but still can, and increasingly will, live this kind of righteousness. So, I want to just call every one of us this morning, every one of us, to come to this Jesus so that he might do in us what only he can do. Now listen, I know I've gone too long. This is a big deal. This is a big deal. And I just want to conclude by acknowledging that for many of you, this is not some kind of abstract theology. This is real life. This is real life for those of you who have actually committed adultery. This is real life for those of you who have had a spouse who has actually committed adultery. This is real life for so many of you who are actually battling and fighting and trying so hard not to engage in this lustful looking. And to all of us in any one of those positions, I want you to realize that ultimately what Jesus is saying is to look to him, because he is enough for every one of us in every one of those situations. He is enough to forgive you of your sin. He is enough to motivate you and compel you and help you to grow in this area. He is enough to bring healing to broken relationships. And he is enough, even when those relationships have been broken beyond repair, he is faithful to be present with you forever. And Christ will never, ever be unfaithful to any of us. So put your life in his hands. Let's pray. God, I simply pray that you would use these hard words this morning, words that are hard for us to hear, to produce the kind of life in us that only you can produce. And even now, as we come to your table, would you use the bread and the cup as a reminder of the incredible, life-altering grace that we have in your faithful Son. We pray in his name. Amen. Church, let's spend